This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. In his latest book, Behave, The Biology of Humans at Our Best and Worst, Robert Morris Sapolsky explores why we do the things we do. The neuroendocrinologist is currently a professor of biology, neurology, and neurological sciences at Stanford. He studied factors affecting a person on the exact moment a behavior occurs, and then he works backward, ultimately ending up at the deep history of our species and its evolutionary legacy. Cincinnati Zoo Director Thane Maynard talked with Dr. Sapolsky about his work.
Hi, Dr. Robert Sapolsky.
Hi, Thane. How are you?
Very well, and thanks for taking a few minutes to talk with us.
Sure, glad to.
Well, I have long admired your books, Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers in a Primate's Memoir. You can imagine, too, a zoologist. Those are just terrific stories.
Well, thanks.
Now, but you've gone other times, too, but particularly with your new book. Now it's to do a bit with human behavior and particularly, as you say, the biology of good and evil. Tell us a bit about that.
Well, it's this new book of mine coming out next month. Full title is Behave, The Biology of Humans at Our Best and Worst.
Mm-hmm.
And what it's looking at is, first off, how difficult it often is to decide what constitutes our best and worst behaviors, in part because these are often in the eye of the beholder. One person's patriot is the next person's terrorist.
Mm-hmm.
But also because it's not terribly interesting to look at just the motoric aspects of a behavior. Okay, your brain tells your spine, tells your muscles to do something, and you behave, you do an action. Much more interesting is the meaning of it. And in some cases, the exact same behavior is like the most horribly violent thing a human can do. In other settings, same exact muscle movements, we give somebody Congressional Medal of Honor, and the biology of understanding context is like so much harder than understanding just the biology of just the behavior itself, what the meaning is.
Absolutely. And I know in the book, you do tackle some tough topics because though people have been around for a while, we haven't changed all that much. So this idea of tribalism, even xenophobia.
Yep. And it's on one hand one of the most unbelievably depressing topics you can focus on when looking at sort of the biology behavior, in that we are incredibly hardwired to have our brains break the world into us's and them's and to not be all that nice to them's. Our brains process categories of what people are in on the scale of milliseconds. Parts of our brain having to do with emotion, fear, threat perception is already processing the face of someone we categorize as an other in a 20th of a second. There's hormones like oxytocin,
mm-hmm.
which make us like wonderfully pro-social and warm and fuzzy to people who we think of as us's, and it makes us more preemptively aggressive to people who count as them's. So on one hand, it's incredibly depressing that it seems virtually inevitable that our brains break the world into us's and them's. What's the grounds for optimism, though, is we're incredibly easily manipulated as to who counts as an us and who counts as a them, and we could change those categories in 2 seconds, depending on the circumstance, and someone who is a them suddenly aligns in a completely different category. So I think it's kind of inevitable that we do that dichotomizing, but it's anything but inevitable what sort of dichotomizing we do with it.
This is all remarkable. It really is, because this is a very broad-reaching thing. Now, tell us a bit more about your work that's led to this, because famously you are a MacArthur Genius Grant recipient and a professor a long time at Stanford University. And yet, when you think of your body of work for the general public, say someone like I would read, it's gone all the way from your work with baboons in Kenya decades ago to, in this case, really studying human behavior.
Yep, and I think that's kind of reflected in the book. I've spent my decades not quite knowing what I wanted to be when I grew up in terms of oscillating between, as you said, a field primatologist studying baboons year after year, the same animals that I've gone back to in a national park in East Africa, while at the same time having a molecular neurobiology lab at Stanford doing stuff like gene therapy on neurons, making them more resistant to stress. And what that straddling of fields does, I think, is mostly leave you with a very, very firm conviction that if you want to make sense of behavior, especially human social behavior, there is no single part of the brain that's the explanation, or here is the gene, or the hormone, or the childhood experience, or the evolutionary mechanism, that all of them are incredibly intertwined. And you pretty much, if you want to make sense of the species as bizarre as we are, you're really going to have to use all those approaches, from what happened 1 second before in that person's nervous system to millions of years of evolutionary pressure that sculpted the species that we are and everything in between.
It really is fascinating the depth at which you're able to look at this today as compared to just one generation ago, when certainly you wouldn't have been doing gene therapy on neurons, et cetera. But on the other hand, it does sound, when you're telling this story, that there's not that big a gap between when, say, you were studying behavior of baboons, who also can be quite competitive, and then this study of humans. You know, it feels like, doesn't it, when you listen to the news, that one of the oldest tricks in the book for a politician or a nation that's in trouble is to say, well, we're being attacked by somebody else and we have to fight because we respond.
Absolutely. As was very cynically said once, one of the best ways to decrease within-group homicide is to invent between-group genocide. One of the great rallying points for organisms, including us, is to decide that even though you may not be thrilled about the rest of you here in this group, they on the other side of the river, they are much more threatening, so we might as well pull it together right now.
Mm-hmm. And we've certainly seen that throughout history. So how do we, as a species in an ever-crowded world, get beyond that?
Well, I think one of the things, I mean, what one has to struggle with endlessly is we're a miserably violent species, just unprecedented the scale of damage we can do to other members of our species. At the same time, we are just an unprecedentedly altruistic and cooperative and self-sacrificial species as well. I mean, just like in terms of an example that would leave every other organism on Earth gasping in surprise, you're in another country. You're at the airport, you're about to fly out of there, you're never going to set foot in that place again, and walking into the airport, you pause for 2 seconds to hold the door open for someone. You're never going to see that person again. You are not establishing a relationship of reciprocal altruism, which mm-hmm. is what the evolutionary biologists really emphasize. We're a weird species in that regard. We do way more socially affiliative things than you see in any other species. And at the same time, we're far more miserable. And over what it's about is context.
Mm-hmm. This really, really is fascinating. Tell a bit more about your work at Stanford, because I think that's a broad spectrum as well.
Well, what I've spent my decades on there is mostly a bad news story, which is, you know, we're now about 60, 70 years into recognizing that stress does crummy things to your blood pressure and your stomach walls and your sex life and your immune system and all of that. We're only about 20 years or so into recognizing all the ways in which it also does adverse things to your nervous system, your brain, and the behavior that comes out of it. So a lot of what my lab has focused on over these years is, how does stress and this one class of stress hormones, how do they damage the nervous system? What do they do? What do they have to do with brain aging? What do they have to do with vulnerability to things like depression or anxiety disorders? What might they have to do with vulnerability to certain neurodegenerative diseases? And, you know, basically, if you want 30 years pulled into a punchline, you know, for the sake of your brain, you should just as well not be stressed. Obviously, much easier said than done, but we actually know a remarkable amount about the molecular biology by now, about how nervous systems don't do very well with chronic stress.
And the thing that I've enjoyed so much about your books in the past is your willingness to do obviously very high level neurological and biomedical research, but then take it to the general public with a book that relates to just what you were talking about that was called years ago, Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. So give us the 30-second answer to why zebras don't get ulcers.
Because they're not smart enough to. I mean, you see a lion leaps out, is chasing a zebra, and like he's either going to be dead in a minute, or if he survives, if you stay and you watch the guy, I'm absolutely confident 3 minutes later he hasn't a thought in his head other than, am I going to eat this blade of grass or that blade of grass? It's not till you get to us smart, socially sophisticated primates that we can sit around and turn on the same exact stress response as does that zebra running for its life, and we turn it on for 30-year mortgages. Or we turn it on because we're a low-ranking baboon and the scary guy is around us all day. We turn it on for purely psychological reasons. And the punchline to that entire field is that's not what the stress response evolved for. For 99% of beasts on this planet, stress is screaming terror in the savannah for 30 seconds, after which it's either over with, you're over with, and if you turn it on chronically instead, as we do for months and years on end, all the great adaptive things that save your neck in 30 seconds, do it chronically, and there's just all sorts of diseases you're more at risk for.
This is just phenomenal. It really is. Dr. Robert Sapolsky, thanks for spending some time with us. We will certainly look forward to your new book that comes out this spring and further success in the future. I look forward to meeting you someday.
Great. Thank you. Take care.
Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
My guest has been Dr. Robert Sapolsky of Stanford University, author of the new book, Behave.